Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 63. I, as ever, am your host, Karen, joined by
Kristen. Hi, everyone.
Yay. Episode 63. Woo. Woo-hoo. This is our last episode of the year.
What?
That is actually a little nuts. I'm
yeah.
Taking it in. Last episode of 2022. We're here. Yep. We made it.
We did. That we did.
Yeah. Getting ever closer to 100 episodes, too.
And the live stream was just yesterday. Yes. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a lot of fun. Thank you to everyone who showed up. That was really cool. We watched Thor, Love, and Thunder. Got to see a lot of the other Riordanverse podcast hosts for the first time visually.
Right. It was nice to put some faces to some names.
Yeah. We talk to them all the time, but, like, it helps now that I know what they look like and also, like, their personalities a little bit more. So, that was a lot of fun. And can't wait till next year to do it all over again.
For the summer solstice.
Yeah, that's true. Summer solstice one. And then, yeah, it'll be cool. As always, if you would like to contact us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We don't have a lot of news right now, and we're actually, because it's the holiday season, because it's the end of the year, we're going to be recording some episodes back to back, and we're going to do news this week, but next week we're actually going to skip the news, and for the episode after that, we're going to skip news entirely because we're recording them early. Magic of podcasting. Aww. Yeah.
And I mean, Becky/Rick, one or both of them, basically said that we're not going to really get a lot of news. This is everybody's break. I mean, in addition to us kind of taking a holiday break, the filming is taking a holiday break. And so, like, yeah, everybody needs a little time at this time of year.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So we won't be doing news, and then we'll do a news catch-up episode when we get back, which will be, like, I think the second Monday of January, and the episodes coming out over the break, basically, will be shorter, quicker, and you can catch up on them easier whenever you have time. But we didn't want to, like, completely not have an episode, so we'll do a couple quick fun ones for you.
Yeah.
The first thing I just want to say is shout out to at Jessica Jill on Twitter, who won our art giveaway.
Congratulations!
Yeah, thank you to everyone who entered. That was a lot of fun. Of course, thank you to Sarah for being willing to do that. It was really awesome. And Jessica knew exactly what she wanted, like, right away, which was awesome.
That's cool.
Yeah, but really appreciate that. We definitely like doing giveaways and that sort of thing. So if you guys have anything in mind that you would like to be able to enter for, like, whether it's books or more art or something else entirely, I would love to keep doing that because I like winning things.
Mm-hmm.
I also kind of like giving things away. So
right. It's a good time.
Yeah. I also wanted to point out Gracie Kim's tweet because really kind of like hit home for me. She said, New York Times bestselling author, it says on the wall. She has a picture of her book covers on her wall, like behind her desk. It looks, the setup is very nice. New York Times bestselling author, it says on the wall, I wish I could go back and tell little me to be proud of my heritage, even if kids were spitting in my lunch and throwing stones at me. I wish I could tell her that what makes her different is what makes her unique, and that embracing all parts of her in all its messiness and complexity and beauty is exactly what will help her shine. I wish she knew that there's been magic inside her all along, and that her greatest superpower will be her choice to use it in a way that's meaningful to her. And of course, like, kids are horrible, and I'm so sad that she was bullied as a child. It's really, really awful. But I love that she's turning that into something that helps children like her with The Last Fallen Star and the Gifted Clan series. It's really beautiful. And to anybody who, you know, works past the trauma of their childhood and is able to make art and to bring light to the world. I really love that, and I really appreciate that. And Gracie is so sweet, and she was a lot of fun to talk to. So happy to see her blossoming.
And just think, there are children reading her books that don't know anything about her heritage at all. So they're reading these stories and learning about this heritage that's probably very different from their own. And they will probably not be the awful children who spat in her lunch. Like, they will never be those kids because they get to read things and learn about other people. And that's even more awesome.
Yeah, it's not just kids like her.
Right.
It's the people that would have picked on them, too. Like, she's changing both sides
right.
of the aisle, and that's
she
something
could be,
to strive
for. She could
for.
Be changing lots of lives in
yeah.
many ways. And that goes for all the RRP authors and all of, you know, all of their stories and characters. And, yeah, it not only does it help people feel represented, which is awesome, but it also exposes people who otherwise may not, you know. Like, if they just see the cover of The Last Fallen Star and read the description and think, this sounds like a cool book, they may not have gotten exposed to the culture of the book
mm-hmm.
and her, you know. And so now they've now seen the world through eyes very different from theirs. And it all makes the world a better place. When we have a chance to kind of think of another person's perspective of the world, it makes everything better.
Yeah. I completely agree.
End of the year, we're getting all philosophical. Ready?
Yeah.
Here we go.
On the flip side of that, if you like the end of the year to be about parties,
We can do parties.
Yeah, we could do parties. Reed Riordan posted an article titled, How to Throw a Camp Half-Blood Themed Holiday Party. And it has this cool new artwork at the top, except you will notice Chiron off to the left without his human legs. He has all horse hooves. I'm just saying, it's not mythologically accurate.
I was scrolling through our Twitter looking for some of the artists that we've retweeted in the
yeah.
last year, because the fan artists, because we'll get to that later in the episode. But I was looking specifically for, like, I had an idea of one or two things that we shared back in, like, April. And I was like, I'm never going to make it this far. But I did stumble across someone's vision of what they thought a centaur looked like, and it was literally just a horse with, like, the face.
I remember a human face. Yeah.
And I could not get out of my head, like, a horse with a human face and human legs.
Yeah.
Like, for some reason, keep the neck, but, like, human legs, because that was, like, a whole other thing. And
yeah.
I was like, that would be so disturbing. Like, I just, yeah. So this whole Chiron has human legs thing is going to continue to be disturbing from
yeah.
here until eternity.
Exactly. I'm kind of glad that he has horse legs in this one. And he's also brown. He's not a
right?
white stallion.
He's not a white stallion.
Yeah.
Nope.
Kind of interesting.
He's got that dark lumberjack look.
He does. He's got his little scarf. It's very cute.
With what should be elbow patches. I don't know if there are elbow patches on that jacket, but I feel like Chiron always needs
yeah,
elbow patches.
Definitely. So if you do want to throw a Camp Half-Blood-themed holiday party, they suggest don't limit yourself to staying indoors, which it is chilly outside, but nice campfire.
And if you can afford to rent little heater things, it's doable.
Yeah, that's true. Go all out with the decorations, bust out the tunes, stick with the culinary classics, and include everyone in the festivities. And I feel like that last one is particularly important.
Definitely. That's for sure.
Yeah.
I was sitting here trying to come up with some way to make culinary classics and blue food work.
Yeah.
I was like, what's culinary?
Like a blue pasta?
What's culinarily blue is what
yeah.
my brain just said. What? But yeah, like, yeah. Yeah, you could do something like that.
Blue pasta, make it fancy. I mean, I think you could dye anything blue if you have enough time and patience.
I was going to say, or you can just be ridiculous and use blue cheese and something.
That's true. I love blue cheese.
Then you can be decadent and call it
yes.
culinary whatever.
Mold. So full of decadence.
/ I won't touch it.
Yeah.
39-foot bowl.
I'll eat it. I'll eat it all.
It's all Karen's.
Yes. So that was it for our news. Like, we're 10 minutes
keep
into
it
the
moving.
Podcast. Yeah.
There's no news right now.
Yeah.
There just isn't. Like,
which
again,
is fine.
The show is already on hiatus. They're taking
yeah.
their Christmas break. It makes sense. And,
yeah.
you know, I'm sure, when we finally get the announcement we're all waiting for, the Zeus and Poseidon casting, yeah, it'll probably be the end of January or maybe even February by the time we get that, and it'll be massive news for us, right, but it yeah might be a bit before we get to find that out.
Yeah. But that's okay. We yep will be patient.
We we'll survive.
Tons of time to wait until the show actually comes out, so honestly, like, I'm not that worried about right it. Right.
What's another month?
Yeah.
Or two, or four.
Or 12. Yeah. But for this episode's discussion, we kind of wanted to do an end-of-the-year roundup, because this was the first full year for us for the podcast, and there was a lot that was announced this year that's going to be coming in the next 1 to 2 years, and I just feel like it's really fun to kind of look back on everything that we've accomplished, everything we've witnessed in the fandom, how much we've grown as a podcast, and just like how far we've come in general. So doing a little end of the year reflection, and hopefully it will be interesting for you guys to listen to.
I was going to say, right off the bat, I'm very proud of us for choosing to do one chapter at a time, because it makes getting ready for the podcast so much less stressful.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, trying to get two quotes and two recaps and two this and two... Like, it just became a lot. Yeah. So I'm honestly very proud of us for making the...
And we can barely, like, make a 90-minute podcast
right
with one chapter.
With one chapter. Especially these chapters. If we yeah were doing two... Yeah. I'd be done. I would have...
We'd have to, like, forego the discussion or something
right
like that.
Yeah. It would have just been insane. So, yeah.
It would have been too much.
I want to give us a pat on the back for making a wise decision, especially for the last Olympian. But I think we'll probably stick with it going forward, just because it does...
Yeah.
It just feels better. It feels less rushed and less
right
chaotic yeah all the time.
Hope you guys are ready for 26 years of Prophecy Radio.
Right?
That's how long it's going to take.
It might take us a hot second.
Yeah, it's going to take us so long to get through everything, but...
Yeah, we'll get there.
But it's very exciting.
Yeah.
The first thing that I wanted to talk about, which was very important to me, because this is one of the things I'm most proud of as a podcast, is our episode titles.
They are delightful.
I think our episode titles are hilarious, especially when they come organically through, like, something random we just said. I really love that. So, what were some of your favorite episode titles from the last year or so?
Well, there are two that kind of, like, jumped out as I was kind of scrolling through the titles that I could see. But I used Instagram because it's so easy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a good idea.
Just scroll through. Two of them that jumped out at me were, A, Junk Drawer God.
Yeah.
Because it just kind of works.
And you know exactly who we're talking about. Like, I'm
yeah
just going to think of Hermes like that forever.
Right? And the way it came about, that episode was a lot of fun.
It
just sticks out in my brain. But the other one that really, like, jumped out at me was Chekhov's sand dollar.
Yeah.
Because it's so true. Like, this sand dollar is, like... You know, you totally think that it's this thing. It's a whole thing. Chekhov's sand dollar.
Yeah, I really like those two. I think Junk Drawer God is very good and just so perfect for Hermes. Chekhov's sand dollar makes me laugh because I still have problems with that sand dollar. And I know some people have tried to explain it to us, but it still doesn't really sit right with me. But, like, it's just such a perfect description of what that actually was. So,
yeah
I was very proud of that one, too. I mean, I have to admit, I have a soft spot for Two Old Ladies Start a Podcast because it's super descriptive, it explains us perfectly well, it's our first episode title.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a long time trying to figure out, like, what to name that episode.
Yeah.
We really batted around a bunch of things. I don't remember any of the other
nope
options now, but it was mirrored after the first chapter of Percy Jackson, too. So,
yeah,
you know, it's so perfect to me. And our first episode is consistently one of our highest listens to, because I think that people just constantly find us. And so it always kind of pops up in the feed that I look at for the analytics. And it just makes me happy every time.
It's a good title.
Yeah.
It's a good premiere title.
Yeah.
Like. It's us.
Yep.
Just two old ladies.
Yep. But I have to say, my favorite episode titles are either Hot Seder Summer,
which is
because
good.
I just imagine Grover, like, in a glow-up sparkling on the beach in like a little bathing suit or something, tanning with some sunglasses on, like
I can almost hear like Masha Rio. Like as he's like walking down the beach.
Yeah, it's like a slow motion.
Yeah.
The hair on his legs is flowing in the wind.
As his hooves through the sand.
There's little glistening off the top of his horns through his curly hair.
Right.
Oh my gosh. The other one though, sassy little Dodo. Because that little Dodo was so sassy.
It's another good one. Yeah.
That chapter is so sad because that's when Pan dies.
Yeah.
But the sassy little Dodo. And it just makes a great episode title.
It really does. It really does. It makes Those are good
me,
ones.
It makes me happy. I love saying them out loud. Okay, so I want to move on to the most interesting thing we learned this year in terms of mythology, I think is kind of where I was coming from for that.
I have such a short-term memory.
Yeah, like, so do I.
I know we learned stuff.
Yeah.
And I know, like, back in May, we had some deep dives or whatever that we, like, learned cool things. And we were like, that's so cool. I'm never going to forget that. And, like...
Definitely forgot.
I don't remember anything. Are you nuts? But I do remember us using procrustean as an adjective, adverb.
Yeah.
And so that continues to stick. But also, just how many things Hermes is a god of, because there's way more to that list.
Yeah.
Like the palm trees, and like there's a whole bunch of stuff that I keep going back to, like, well, I what all is he a god of? Like, because we know some of the obvious things, like travel and, and that sort of stuff. But, like, there's so much more that he's involved in. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think kind of taking a moment to look at Hermes and say, like, he does actually have a lot of things that are under his purview. And it makes him the junk drawer god. It really does.
Maybe it's just because he was, like, the most recent god that we did. But I find, like, his birth and his like first day of being alive sticks out in my mind a lot. That was really interesting to me, the way that you could see how he evolved as a god, going from like the god of, I think it was, I don't remember exactly how it started, but it explains how he was able to go back and forth between the underworld, how he became the god of roads and therefore the god of travelers and like therefore the god of thieves and stuff like that. And just how they kept adding more on, but it was a very logical progression.
Right.
That was super interesting to me.
Yeah.
No, especially because you're right, he is the god of so many things.
So many things.
Yeah.
And so many things that are so broad. Like, he's the god of travel. Well, is that, like, purposeful travel or, like, vacation travel or all of the travel? Does that make him god of roadways? Does that make him god of the skies? Like travel is so many things. It's so broad that it really does encompass a lot. So, yeah. The other thing that I distinctly remember is the poisonous dripping eyes of the Furies.
I do not remember this.
Like, I remember that there were, during some of our monster episodes, some of the descriptions of their appearances are so different from how we kind of envision them in the Percy series. And the one that, I just remember that the Furies were so much more terrifying than they are in the series. And in the series, Mrs. Dodds is very scary.
Yeah.
But, like, the actual, like, description of what the Furies are supposed to look like includes these blood dripping eyes with the, and the blood is poison and it just burns when it hits things, and like that's just terrifying to me. And it's like tears, but not really tears, it's just dripping whenever they need it to. And yeah, it's very odd, but I just remember being very scared by that.
Yeah, I for some reason must have just blocked that out of my memory.
It was a while back. We did the Furies in
that,
like,
was
April.
Like, yeah, that was pretty early, but that's really cool. And yeah, I mean, I keep thinking about, okay, I'm probably gonna remember Percy Jackson a lot more than I ever have, because we're literally discussing each and every chapter, so I'm really hoping the details, like, stick with me. But there's even been episodes where I've been like, I know we talked about this, we did a whole episode on this, and I just don't remember what happens.
Right.
So it's very frustrating when you have terrible memory, but, you know, we do the best we can. That's what the fandom page is there for.
Right? Thank goodness.
We would be lost without it.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the most interesting thing we learned this year for me is that Chiron has two human legs.
That's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
That's going to continue to recur.
That is
going to
stay with me for the rest of my life because it's so weird. Chiron having two human legs, I think, is just, it's really interesting, and I like that it's because you can tell he's meant to be different from other centaurs. It was a good way to distinguish him from his brethren. So it makes sense, but it's still very shocking.
Yes.
And nerve-wracking.
Disturbing.
Yes, disturbing was the word I was looking for. But I have to say, you know, all the other mythology that we've gotten to learn about thanks to Rick Riordan Presents has been really important to me because we're not exposed to a lot of that mythology as much as we are to Greek and Roman or even to Egyptian mythology, Norse mythology to a certain extent. And I've loved every single Rick Riordan book that we've read, and I loved learning different mythology and folklore and just different cultures, and even when there's like description of food, like all of that. Gracie's books is full of that, and like I really love that. However, I have to say, and maybe again this is just because it's been the most recent, but I really loved learning about Ghanaian mythology from Roseanne A. Brown with the Serwa Boateng's books, because a lot of that stuff was very new to me. I did not know any of it. And the vampires, you know, the fireflies that are vampires, like, that's so interesting.
Agreed, yeah. You have, like, little bits of some cultural traditions kind of, like, pop into your knowledge base.
Mm-hmm.
Like, specifically thinking of, like, Tiger Honor and some of that. Like, you know some of that just from pop culture and things that you kind of absorb as you go through the world. But, like, the Ghanaian folklore is a totally new animal for me. Like, that's...
Yeah.
I've never knew about the whole firefly vampire thing. And, like, the way their, like, god system is set up is very different from kind of some of the things that I've heard and learned of before. I'm fascinated by it, honestly. It's really cool. Also, with Ballad and Dagger, some of the folklore in that was things that I had never really been exposed to at all. And so it was kind of neat to see the blending of cultures and all of that in New York City and, like, all of that. So, yeah, those two probably stand out the most to me right now. But
yeah, that one was such an interesting blend of so many different cultures in one place. And I feel like it's very representative of what New York City is like. And yeah, just seeing it at the forefront was really interesting to me. I also wanted to say that it's really interesting that we got to read Roseanne A. Brown's book this year, because last year I read this book called Skin of the Sea by Natasha Bowen, which is about West African mythology and folklore, basically about the Mamiwata, which are mermaids, and, you know, West African mermaids. And I was like, oh, that's such an interesting concept. I don't know anything about it.
I remember you reading that.
Yeah, I really wanted to read it. And it was good. And the covers are stunning. And I'm reading Soul of the Deep, the second and final book, right now. And they talk about, and I want to say Aja, I think is how you pronounce the fireflies.
Mm-hmm.
They're in there. And they have Orissas and just, like, the different kinds of mythology. Like, I can see the similarities with Roseanne's book. And
or, like,
so,
where some of those things have kind of crossed into other...
Yeah.
As they've kind of interacted, you can see where things kind of work with each other. That's so
cool.
Yeah,
it is. And they're good books, and they're especially good if you want, you know, if you like mermaid books but want to explore different cultures, or if you like West African mythology of any sort or just want to read something new. They're really beautifully written, and if you liked Roseanne's book, definitely pick it up. Skin of the Sea by Natasha Bowen and Soul of the Deep by Natasha Bowen. They're very good.
Nice.
Yeah. Speaking of Roseanne.
Yeah.
What was your favorite interview?
I mean, again, maybe it's because it was the most recent.
Yeah.
It's possible. I have a terrible memory. I really did enjoy talking to all of the authors this year that we got a chance to talk to, because they were all so wonderful. Nice. Yeah, and it, Karen and I get very nervous when we have to have, I mean, I don't know if you people have noticed. We get very nervous when we're going to have anybody else join in, not because we're scared of them, but usually it's because we're just worried that nothing's going to, it's not going to go smoothly. Yeah. It's going to, like, take up a bunch of extra time, and we don't want to, like, ruin their morning or whatever. Right. Like, we want to get in, record, have fun, and then, you know, keep things moving. So, like, it, we get really nervous before these things, but as soon as we're done, we're always like, that went so well.
Yeah.
Like, oh, man. You guys should just hear us, because as soon as it's done, it's like, that was so much fun. Like, yeah. And honestly, we said that after every interview we did this year.
Yeah.
And they were always, you know, incredibly delightful, but Roseanne stands out.
Yeah.
She still just, she stands out for me a little.
One of us.
And I think that is part of it. She has so much of that, like, fangirl energy that we definitely have, and from Hyperbole and from, you know, all the things that we're fans of. And this is a fandom podcast. Like, the whole point of this is to fangirl out occasionally. Yeah. And so, it, yeah, she's definitely the one that sticks out just because it was so much fun talking to her.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of my favorite things about the interviews is, you know, obviously I love talking to the authors about their books. As a writer myself and as two people who have covered fandom for a very long time, like, we know how to talk about that stuff. We know how to interview people. But I think a lot of my enjoyment also comes from their inspirations, like what they watched or what they read that inspired them to write this story, or the things that they love, like the movies and TV shows and all of that. That's just because it's like, yes, we, you know, you might be a New York Times bestselling author who's working with Rick Riordan, but, you know, you also love Buffy.
Yeah.
And that just makes me really happy, and it's really easy to connect to people who are interested in the same things as you are, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of personalizes things to for me, and it makes it just so much more enjoyable because of that.
Agreed.
Yeah. I mean, Roseanne was obviously one of the best interviews, I think, because we got to connect to her on that level very easily. But I have a really soft spot for Roshni Chokshi, because out of all the Rick Riordan Presents books, like, she was the first one I read. I got to meet her in person, and she was really, really lovely. And I just love her brain and how it works, and her Instagram feed is so beautiful, by the way. She's always looking very posh and regal.
I think that's why she, I love Roshni, but she's so beautiful that it's intimidating.
It is. And, oh, it 100%
is. And so
I
think I was scared a little bit for that one, but not because she's scary, just because it's like,
when I met her at the Disney dinner that I was at, like, quite a few years ago at this point, I think it was before Arusha had come out, but I think it was in promotion of that. You know, I got to sit down right next to her at this table, because each table got a different author, and she was sitting right there, and I was like, oh my god, she's so beautiful. But then she's, like, weird and quirky.
Right.
And you're just like, yes, I love this for you.
Yeah.
And Arusha, obviously, is just such a good series that, like, that was a dream to be able to have her on the podcast.
Absolutely. I think that was also part of it, too, is she's definitely, because she was one of the first Rick Riordan Presents authors to publish, she's kind of the old hat. She's the established one for me. Like, Roseanne, this was her first book, so I think for me, knowing that, like, this was Roseanne's first trip through all of this made it easier for me to kind of bond with her.
Yeah.
Versus Roshni, I have so much reading to do.
Yeah.
Like, I have to catch up because I'm behind on Arusha. Yeah.
I feel so I think that way about Gracie, too. Like, that was her first, you know, publishing and all of that, and it's just like,
yeah, so it made it really a little easier to kind of, like,
a little more approachable, a little less intimidating.
We love all of you. We really do.
Yes. They're all listening to
and
this
we're not
right
scared
now.
Anymore, I swear.
But I have to admit, I was very intimidated by Daniel Jose Holder. Kristen knows this. I was freaking out for a while ahead of that interview. But I was also really excited. I just think that he's, you know, writing the High Republic Star Wars stories, I feel like he's kind of on another level. And he is a very accomplished person, let alone an accomplished author. He has all of this life experience that I just I cannot wrap my head around. He's done so much already in his life, and his writing is beautiful, and he just seems so intelligent that I was so scared to interview him. But it ended up being a really cool interview, and I think, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, and my dad always reminds me, they're just people, too. You know, they're just regular people. And I always forget that when I go to interview somebody, because when you respect somebody's art so much, when you hold them up a little bit higher because they do something that inspires you, it's hard not to be intimidated or not to feel like, okay, you're different from me. Yeah. And I think every time we do this, it just reminds me a little bit more, just one more time, that like, no, like, they're nerds like we are. They love writing like we do. They love reading like we do.
I just had a brain flash. If we are ever so lucky as to interview Rick himself,
yeah,
do you know the entire mess we will be for like a week, a month, 2 weeks, whatever, however much time they give us before that happens.
It's like,
we would be messes.
Yeah. And I've interviewed him before face to face, like in person.
Yeah.
And I'm still going to be like, oh,
right. It still would be like, I'm supposed to have words and talk and form sentences while we have this discussion. But we all, I mean, I will say, Rick is really good about being very approachable. Like, he used to be on Twitter answering people's questions all the time. He still answers questions on Goodreads, despite having an insanely busy schedule and no time to run his own social media anymore. I get that.
Yeah.
He's not doing it because he wants to be away from us. He's doing it because he literally has no time.
Yeah.
But, like, yeah, and even with Becky taking over and kind of being the face of his books right now on social media, and that sort of thing, like, being so approachable, I never feel like he's untouchable, like, you can't get to Rick, but it would still be like, we have to, like, talk and ask questions. Okay, let's see how this goes. And, like, he's a fanboy, too. He has, he has people and things that he's, you know, a massive fan of and excited to meet and see and all of that, too, so... He's just one of us.
Yes.
But it would, you know, it would be just as crazy me talking to him as it is with everybody else. Like, it would be nuts.
Yeah, it would. But, you know, when that day comes.
Yep, it's going to come, right? It's going to happen.
It'll be a lot of fun. Speaking of things that we enjoy and being inspired by other people, one of the things that got me most excited this year as we really jumped into the Percy Jackson fandom was all of the fan artists. And of course, we just had our interview with Sarah, and they got to talk about the people that, you know, they respect and the art that they love. And I think just discovering how much talent there is in this fandom really got me excited. But what are some of the artists that you discovered this year that, like, their pieces just really stuck out in your mind?
Okay, when it comes to fan art, I am terrible. Because most of the time, I find, like, a piece, I'll come across a piece on, like, Twitter or something that I love, and I'll like it, or I'll retweet it, or whatever. But then I feel like I completely lose track of the artist, and I completely, you know, like, I just see that one thing and I'm like, that's really cool. And then I go about my day, and that piece of art kind of sticks with me, but I don't necessarily, I'm not really good at, like, tracking art styles and that sort of thing. It's just never, it's never been a thing that, like, really, you know, grasped me. But that being said, I was a massive fan and enjoyed seeing all the different incarnations of Annabeth this year, especially. With Leah's casting, I feel like Annabeth fan art has gone through a bit of a renaissance.
Yes.
And we've seen some traditional Annabeths, we've seen some brand new Annabeths, we've seen Annabeths that don't necessarily physically represent any of the actors who've played her, but that it's an interpretation by this artist or this artist that kind of uses bits from both, or a completely different version. And it's so cool. Like, I love seeing all of these artists kind of say, you know what, I'm gonna do what I want, and I'm gonna do it this way, and this is my Annabeth. And it's just very refreshing. With Leah's casting, I think kind of spurred a lot of inspiration and a lot of, like, it, I don't want to say, like, permission, but I think it feel like it gave more permission for people to, to change things and to kind of really make Annabeth their own character in their art. Well, there is an artist I'm going to talk about in a second. More or less, the Annabeth fan art this year, I feel like, has really been incredible.
I completely agree with that, and especially, like you said, it almost gave people permission to just do whatever they want with it and interpret. And a lot of artists had been interpreting Annabeth and a lot of the characters in different ways. You know, I've seen Brown Percy and Black Percy and, like, all these different, all the characters have been all different ethnicities and everything, and I love that so much because this is fan art. You can make it however you want. When you read these books, you can interpret the character however you want. And, I mean, you've listened to us enough discuss these books. Sometimes we forget how they're described in the actual book. I keep thinking back to Tiger Honor, where, like, I imagine the captain with a tiger head, even though that's not... he does not have a tiger head.
Yeah.
But, like, in my head, that's just what he looks like. And, like, that's fine, you know?
Right.
Like, that's not... It might not be, like, correct to the canon, but, like, nobody's quizzing you on this.
Yeah.
It's fine. Like, you can make it however you want to make it. You can interpret it whatever way you want, whatever makes you happiest. And I just, yeah, I loved seeing all of the Annabeths. And I hope that continues even after the show comes out.
When I'm reading a female main character book, the female main character always ends up being a brunette with brown eyes. It doesn't matter what ethnicity she is. She always ends up being a brunette in my brain. And it's because I'm putting myself in their shoes.
Yeah.
And so, for some reason, I always change their hair color in my head. So, like, very blonde characters who are described as blonde over and over again end up being brunettes in my head. I think it's why the original, like, movie Annabeth casting never shook me.
Oh.
Is because in my head, she's a brunette.
Yeah.
Because Annabeth was my entry point to the story and was where I, you know, associated most closely. And so it was like, why are people, why do we, oh, yeah, oh, I guess she is blonde.
Yeah.
My bad.
Yeah.
Because in my brain, she's a brunette.
And you're always going to latch on to, like, different characteristics. Like, for some people, the fact that she was blonde was very important because that was at a time when you had all of the dumb blonde jokes and this kind of broke the mold in a lot of ways the same way Buffy did. And for other people, that probably never even occurred to them. Maybe it was, you know, just the fact that she was intelligent or the fact that she loved architecture or, you know, that she had curly hair versus straight hair. Doesn't matter what color it was, you know?
Yeah. But there is a fan artist, as I was kind of going it through the podcast Twitter and some of my own Twitter, there is one artist who's popped up a couple of times with pieces that absolutely stunned me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at Alicia Trunfio on Twitter, especially the Will Solis Nico art. I know we talked about this on the pod when it came out, because there's this one piece that I linked to in the show notes, and hopefully Karen will add that in the show notes when she does them, because she's awesome and does that for me. But it's this piece where Will is kind of coming down from the sky, and Nico is kind of coming up from, I'm assuming, the underworld. And the light and the dark are meeting, and it's absolutely stunning what she did with, like, light in this picture, and the light and the darkness, and Will's skin tone actually being darker because he's, like, tanned versus Nico being pale, but Nico still feeling dark, like, his character feeling, like, dark.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool, like, how she managed to balance this piece of art, and it's very well done, and the style is very pretty, and honestly kind of, like, minimalist in the lines and the use of lines.
Yeah.
But it's, again, so pretty. And then there's another one that's, again, of Nico and Will that has very similar, like, properties to it that this does. That, again, just takes me out. I'm like, I really like her style. So
yeah.
She's probably one that I'm going to make a point to kind of keep an eye on and look out for her stuff.
I completely agree. And that first one you were talking about, I remember replying to them and just being like, make this the cover of the book.
Yeah.
Because, I mean...
I remember that now, yes.
It was so stunning and it was so shocking because I think that was the day that the announcement for the book came out and all of a sudden all these people already had these drawings that fit the Sun and the Star theme. And I was like... You people are incredible. It's intimidating me. But I really, that one piece was so beautiful. I mean, the other one that you linked to as well is really beautiful.
Yeah.
And there's just, I mean, I'm constantly impressed by all of the artwork that comes out of the fandom, all of the creativity that comes out of the fandom. And it's just, sometimes it's too much to keep up with, and other times I'm like, just give me more. Like, I just want more. And, of course, I have to shout out Sarah, because their artwork is so amazing, and they've been so good to us, and been a friend of the podcast for so long, and I really love that.
Getting a chance to talk to them was really fun. Like, I'm not an artist. I am not a drawer of things because I do not have that skill. But I loved kind of having the opportunity to get into that headspace and like play a little bit in how fan art kind of comes to be for them and like how it works. And that was really, really fun for me because that's just, my brain does not work in that way. My brain is very wordy and musically inclined as opposed to actually like image-based, image inclined. Right. So that was a really interesting discussion for me. And thank you, Sarah, for having that conversation and like letting that all kind of happen.
Yeah, that awesome. Episode was super interesting. The other artist I really want to shout out is Soya, S-O-I-A, and on Twitter it's S-O-I-A underscore JPG, because their style just really speaks to me. It's got like an almost sketchy quality to it while still being like very clean, and I really enjoy it. I think their characters are beautiful. Even the characters for fandoms that I'm not a part of makes me want to be a part of that fandom. That's how good their art is. But I just love watching them create, and they have a shop, and I bought a bunch of stickers from them because I love stickers, and they have a lot of really cool Percy Jackson stuff. Their style is just, like, really recognizable for me, and whenever I come across their stuff, I'm like, oh, this is so good, and then I look to see who did it, and I'm like, it's so good. So, yeah, there's just, but, I mean, there's so much, and obviously, like, Valinci's style, too, is just completely taking over the fandom. They're, like, Hades, Percy Jackson, AU artwork and comic is just incredible. Like, I just, you know, I'm also intimidated by their talent because it's just incredible. But yes, obviously we love some good artists.
Mm-hmm. And there, again, as I said, I'm so bad at like making note of the artist and like returning to, I know I would love that. I would love to make note of an artist that I like and go back to their stuff, just like you would a fan fiction author or an author, like, oh, they wrote a new book, I'm going to read that book. I know I would like to do that, but my brain has not mentally begun doing that.
Yeah.
So hopefully that's something maybe this year I can kind of keep better track of some of the artists I really like, because there's always so much fun stuff. Especially with the podcast Twitter, because we're so Percy-centric. Yeah. I think I get a chance to see more of it than I would on my timeline.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I have so many things covering my timeline, from sports to movies to whatever, that being able to kind of use the podcast one to see all this Percy Jackson art is really cool.
Yeah, I agree. And whenever I come across an artist I really like, I follow them on the podcast Twitter, and I feel like I should make a list of the artists that we like.
I'm definitely down for that.
Because then we'd be able to visit them a lot more easily.
It would be very cool.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the things that I really wanted to talk about this episode too was our episode lengths. Because I was like, we need to see what the longest episode is and what the shortest episode is. And for the longest episode, I would have bet money that it was episode 60, the one that we just did that was like 2 hours, 8 minutes.
I mean, that would either that or Blogapalooza, because I feel like when we did the two blog posts, I feel like we talked forever.
Yeah. Neither one of those is the longest one. The longest one was episode number 31, Infernal Monster Lordship. This is when we got the... Also a great title.
It was a good one.
It was when we got the Aryan and Leah casting, plus we did the Hades deep dive, a big god to discuss, plus it was the last two chapters of the Titan's Curse. Came in at 2 hours, 29 minutes. I did not realize we put out a 2.5 hour episode.
I'm so sorry. Guys, or for those of you who like long ones, you're welcome.
Yes, thank you for listening. Either way,
right?
Yeah,
that's so funny.
And we had two episodes come in at an hour and a minute, so we've not undershot the hour yet. I'm sure it'll happen at some point. Maybe this week when we record.
I was going to say episodes. There's a chance those will be shorter.
We
than
say
hour.
That, and then they'll be 90 minutes.
Right? God. We're incapable.
I know. We just love to talk about this stuff.
We really do.
But the one who won is episode number 59, which came in at 1 hour, 1 minute, and 42 seconds. The next closest one was 52 seconds, so it was pretty close. Mm-hmm. And this is when we did the monster guide for the pit scorpions, which, you know, that discussion was pretty light because there wasn't too much to talk about. It was a light news week, and it was the last Olympian, chapter 13. And I think that was honestly right before. I think chapter 14 might have been, like, the really long one or something. Yeah. That's when the chapter started getting bulky. So, yeah. To wrap up this discussion, though, I want to talk a little bit about the biggest announcement that we got this year. And I feel like yours is a really solid choice.
Okay, yours, both of yours, because you kind of have two things.
Yeah, I do.
Both of yours are definitely bigger than mine. But for some reason, when I read this on our little prompt sheet, when I was like, okay, biggest announcement, I don't know if it's because that Hermes episode was so recent or what, but Lin-Manuel Miranda's casting just popped in my head, and I was like, you know, that was a really big announcement. It kind of... I mean, we had gotten some casting before, but nobody's so big that we were like, okay, you know, like, this is, like, the famous face that's going to be in this. Because, let's face it, you do need one or two, like, famous faces to kind of get people's interest sometimes.
Right.
And I never, in my wildest dreams, thought Lin-Manuel Miranda would be playing Hermes. Yeah. No
that's,
way.
That's when we were like, oh, they're throwing Disney money at this.
Right. Like, we already knew production budget-wise it was, like, big, but when you learn about a piece of casting like that, it really just kind of makes you go, oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything is possible now.
And it was just kismet because we had already planned to talk about Hermes, and so his casting fit perfectly into our timeline, and it was just kind of the perfect episode. And so that jumps out at me. Lynn's casting and the week we talked about Hermes just was a big episode for me.
Yeah. Apparently. I completely agree. And honestly, that probably would have been my choice too if you hadn't had it in there, just because I think it was recent memory, but also it was pretty surprising to be like, Lin-Manuel Miranda is going to be in our show.
And they just kind of dropped it. Yeah. Like, oh, by the way.
Yeah. I've noticed, Rick has a tendency of doing this. We don't get a ton of heads up when something big is coming, which I'm fine with. Like, I don't mind being taken by surprise.
It's one of the qualities he shares with Beyonce.
Yeah, that's true.
Rick and Beyonce, same person.
Yeah. Rick, Beyonce, Riordan.
There you go.
But this question was a tough one for me because I have two really solid picks for it. The first one being that I could not concentrate on anything the day that Walker was announced.
I think I forgot it happened this year.
Yeah.
Like, same with, honest to God, same with Leah and Aryan, because it's like, it feels like it was so long ago.
We got the green light in January, didn't we?
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. And then Walker was, like, a little while after that.
Yeah. I honestly cannot keep straight that all happened this year.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, Walker's announcement was massive. Like, that was very exciting, and everybody just kind of went, yep.
Yeah, and that was the cool thing to see, is the fandom come together and just be like, yep, that's our Percy now, yeah. And knowing that he was going to be perfect, and then watching the Adam Project and just being like, oh my god. I mean, I had just watched it, I think, is what it was. Yeah, because we had both seen it already, and then it was like, that kid's going to be Percy Jackson, and it was so exciting, and I remember between that and the day that the show got greenlit, I had work to do. I had, like, deadlines to meet, and I could not think of anything else. I was just scrolling Twitter all day, and it was really hard to concentrate.
And not to mention finding out how big a fan he is of this series. Like,
yeah.
Like, a young actor like that, they don't always come knowing... Yeah, no. Walker knows these books and is a huge fan, and that is so cool.
I really loved it. The other one I have to say is Chalice of the Gods, because... I gotta say, like, I wasn't that surprised about the Nico book. Like, I was, obviously. It was very exciting. The most surprising thing about that announcement, which I think was last year anyway, was that he was co-writing
right.
with Mark. But I kind of knew that if he had already said he was working on standalone novels, and I knew Nico was going to be first. I mean, there was no way he wasn't going to do Nico first. So that one didn't really catch me off guard. But Chalice of the Gods,
that
a new trio book, that was really surprising.
Yeah. I mean, let's face it, we all basically believe, on a regular basis, that he's done writing Percy.
Right.
Like, Percy's had a lot of story and a long time in the spotlight, and it would make sense if there's other characters and other worlds and other stories he wants to tell. But apparently Percy nudged his way in there and said, you've still got more.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and that makes me so happy, because I am more than happy to go back and fill in some of the gaps and the blanks in, you know, our time with Percy. And it's huge. That was a huge one too.
And it means a lot to me that he basically wanted to write the book in support of the TV show. It was kind of like, okay, Disney books, if you help me do this show thing, if you support me in this, then I will write you another book. And it just, like, to me, that tells me he really cares about this TV show being successful, and it gives me a lot of hope that we're gonna get a season 2, 3, 4, 5 and spinoffs and Magnus Chase and
all of the things.
Yeah,
they are going to be in the Rick Riordan business.
Yeah,
not just the Percy Jackson business. Yeah. They're gonna be in the Rick Riordan business because they've signed on for Daughter of the Deep, and they, you know, like, it just, I feel like they are investing in Rick, finally.
Yeah.
Which is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Disney Publishing has owned Percy Jackson, like, the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So why did it take this long for them to properly, you know? Yeah. But I'm excited. And, yeah, it's gonna be awesome. Yeah.
I want a Star Wars-level shared universe, TV shows, movies, books, everything.
Let's do the thing.
And, like, you know, Stephen King has gotten so many of his books adapted, and they're kind of in a loose shared universe as well, so why can't Rick Riordan do it? His books are a lot more tightly knit. Kids will love them. Families will love them.
It would be awesome.
Do it. They're doing it, but, you know, keep doing it.
Forever.
Forever.
Not allowed to stop.
Never, ever. Yeah. Whew, that was actually a lot more of an intense look back. I was like, do we have enough points to talk about Kristen? I was a little worried that, you know, there wasn't going to be enough content.
We weren't going to have enough to talk about.
Yeah.
Ah.
But I feel like that was a really good look back at this year. Yeah. And honestly, like, thinking of everything that happened this year has me really excited about next year, because
we know
there's going to be a lot coming next year. You know, job security.
Yeah.
We have job security with this podcast, so there's never going to not be something to talk about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The show is really good for that. It constantly gives us little, you know, whether it's casting news or news about some other story bit that's going to make the show, or a new detail that we're learning about from Rick or whatever. The show has been a really great blessing in that regard, that there's just always something new to kind of, you know, give a little thought to. And we started looking at the gods and the monsters because we were like, hey, you know, now's a good time to kind of get an idea of what the book says these look like, so that when we see the show, we can kind of say, hey, yeah, we knew that about Zeus. Like, we already knew that that was, so it's really the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, I completely agree. And so is the last Olympian. I mean, its gifts aren't always good or nice.
Sometimes its gifts are great in size and deep in, I don't even.
Sometimes the gift is death.
It's just...
We should just talk about it. I knew this chapter was coming, but it was still kind of rough.
Yeah. All right. So, of course, we're talking about chapter 17, entitled, I Sit on the Hot Seat. Selena, dying, listens as Clarice scolds her for acting so foolishly. But all this daughter of Aphrodite does is apologize. Then she opens her hand, and a necklace, complete with Kronos' scythe charm, is revealed. Selena was Luke's spy, convinced by him that she was saving lives. She begs for forgiveness and mutters about seeing Charlie again as she takes her final breath. Clarice makes it clear that Selena will be remembered as the hero she was, and then takes up a sword to go make Kronos pay. Clarice then leads charge after charge into the enemy forces, with the dragon's body attached to the back of her chariot, waving as she pushes Kronos' army further and further back. Percy and Talia even see her glowing red with the blessing of Ares. Clarice begins calling for Kronos to meet her and fight, but the army just retreats behind a Drakene wall and holds. Chris Rodriguez tasks himself with keeping an eye on her and hopefully convincing her to sleep at some point. Talia and the hunters will help stand guard while Annabeth and Percy go to Olympus to set up the final defenses. The Empire State Building lobby is filled with wounded and resting half-bloods. The final advantage they have is that in order to get to Olympus, the monsters will have to take the elevator, which means only a few at a time and some may not fit at all. So the army will have to funnel in and might give our demigod forces a chance to save Olympus. While it appears they have no more reinforcements to summon, Percy has a thought and sends a message with Mrs. O'Leary, who shadow travels somewhere? Percy and Annabeth then head back toward the elevator and see Grover kneeling over a dying Linnaeus. Once the old satyr passes, he turns into a laurel sapling, which Grover wants to plant in the gardens of Olympus. Our original trio, Percy, Annabeth, and Grover, ride the elevator together. Annabeth admits to Percy during this ride that she believes him about Luke now. It wasn't until she heard from Selena's mouth how badly he used her that she could believe he was truly lost. Annabeth tries to funnel her disappointment into anger toward Percy, but he just quietly reminds her that they're on the same side. When the doors burst open, the dreariness of Olympus strikes them all. Boarded windows, empty streets, and just an overall feeling of depression hits you. A field hospital is set up in the parks with Apollo's children and spirits of nature trying to heal those in need. Percy notices Pollux, Dionysus' son, with a broken arm. Percy insists that Pollux has done enough and encourages him to stay and help with the wounded rather than going back to the front lines. Percy and Annabeth then push forward to the throne room, looking to see how they can shore up their defenses for when Kronos makes it up there, as they know that's going to be his sole target. When they enter, they see Hestia and the Ophiotaurus, followed by Rachel Elizabeth Dare, clutching Pandora's jar at the foot of Zeus's throne. Percy escorts her to meet Hestia, who greets the mortal as if she's been waiting for her the whole time. Rachel then admits to Percy that her pull toward him was really just her pull toward this world. He was merely the door to this whole new reality for her. Their destinies are not intertwined. Percy takes a moment and looks around. As he looks, he remembers many things he's seen and been told, from the warm scenes from Hestia's hearth to the warning from Prometheus, as well as wise words from both Chris Rodriguez and Nico D'Angelo. Suddenly, Percy knows what he has to do. He picks up Pandora's jar and offers it as a gift to Hestia, because she is the last Olympian, and the most important. It warms the hearth a bit. Definitely a good sign. Percy then marches to his father's throne and asks Annabeth and Grover to help him get into it, to get Poseidon's attention. Poseidon almost blasts him, but the two get a chance to talk. Percy is recalling Poseidon to Olympus. He must abandon his undersea domain for his true home. Also, Tyson is doing fine. Percy convinces Poseidon to help, then hops down from the throne, his sleeves and singed hair smoking. Then Talia bursts into the throne room. The enemy is advancing, and Kronos is leading the charge. Dun, dun, dun!
So many of the chapters can end like that, I swear.
I know, but this one just felt especially poignant in its dun-dun-dun-ness, because We're getting closer and closer.
This is the end of the book. We only have a couple more chapters left.
We're backed up to the Empire State Building. Now they're literally trying to shore up defenses in Olympus because they know that it's only a matter of time. Mm-hmm. And Kronos is leading the charge now. He's not hiding behind his monster army. And so, it's getting close. The end is near.
And we've been waging this war, fighting this battle for, like, 6 or 7 chapters now. I mean, it literally started halfway through the book, so...
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It's a big deal.
Okay, so we should probably start this discussion at the beginning, rather than ignoring the pain.
I guess.
So, we learn, at the end of the last chapter, we learn that Selena is dying. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning of this one, we learn that not only is she dying... But she was the traitor. Yeah. She was the spy.
Which I think we both remembered throughout this book. Yeah. However, I was trying to think about it really hard. I don't think I would have guessed this the first time I read it.
Mm-mm.
I don't
think I know
was,
I didn't.
Yeah, I don't think there was really any indication that it was gonna be her. Because all of her reactions, you could just... explain away as she's still upset over Charlie.
Yeah.
You know? So I think this was a really good twist in the book originally.
Yeah. Once you know it, you can kind of see some of her reactions.
Yeah.
They feel different once you know.
That was really interesting reading this again.
Yeah.
Is like knowing that was the case and then going, oh, that's why she reacted. That's why she cried in this moment.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it does color things a little different once you already know that Selena is the spy. But it doesn't make it any less sad to read knowing that it's coming.
And that was a thing that kind of surprised me because I don't feel any differently about Selena than I did before. I'm not mad at her. I'm not, like, upset with her because I feel like she's more a victim than a perpetrator. And this whole thing with her and Luke seems really important to me. She helped Luke because he had been her friend. He had been nice to her. But when she realized how wrong it was, she wanted to stop. And then that's when he started manipulating her, started threatening her, and she felt that there was no choice but to continue following him.
I think it also helps that she didn't wait to be found out. Mm-hmm. She didn't just go with the flow. She took the task of going back to camp to get Clarice and to get the Ares cabin. And she did something to change what was happening.
Yeah.
She saw just how bad... She knew the Draken was coming.
Mm-hmm.
She knew they needed the Ares cabin there. And so she not only took that on and went back to convince Clarice, but she donned her armor and led her forces to manipulate Clarice into coming to battle because it was necessary. And so, like, I feel like that helps me to... see Selena in a more favorable light than otherwise I might have. Like, I may have blamed her more. I may have been more angry with her. But she really does try to do what's right and try to help in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And that works for me.
And I think, like, in the end, she did make the ultimate sacrifice.
She did.
And so it's kind of hard. She did try to right her specific wrongs because she knew about the Draken and therefore went back to get the Ares cabin. I think even if she hadn't have died, I don't think I would have been that mad at her just because I feel like she was doing the best she could. She was grieving. She wanted to believe that Luke was a good person in the same way that Annabeth wants to believe that he's a good person.
Yep.
And she unfortunately got firsthand experience that that's not necessarily the case.
Yeah, it's honestly, if you think about it, Annabeth could have been in a very similar situation.
Yeah.
And we don't know what choice she would have made.
Mm-hmm.
If Luke, I mean, we know Luke came to her at one point and she did not go with him and Hermes blames her for that. We know that she had an opportunity to go. But at that point, she already knew enough about what Luke was doing to feel like it was wrong. When Selena was brought into Luke's thing, I don't think Selena knew what Annabeth knew by the time she had a chance. You know what I mean? So, like, yeah. if from the beginning Luke had said, like, Annabeth, I need you. I want you on my side. It could have turned out very differently. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to really blame Selena because, you know, Luke went from friend to foe. And so there is going to be some blurriness in that as you make that transition. And you just, if you don't recognize it early enough, you can find yourself on the wrong side. And I think that's more or less what happened with Selena.
Yeah, it was absolutely nothing malicious on her part. It was just trusting the wrong person.
She thought she was saving lives. She thought she was helping. She thought this was the right thing to do. And then as soon as she realized it wasn't, it became, I have to do it or he's going to do this. And, yeah.
And I think on top of that, another reason why this whole situation feels okay is because really none of the other demigods blame her either.
Yeah.
Like, Clarice is very insistent that she's a hero. Percy kind of lets it go. Even the Stoll brothers let it go, so.
Yeah. And I mean, honestly, Annabeth, too. Like,
yeah.
She could have stuck to her guns and said, like, Luke was my friend, too, and you don't see me do it. But, like, no, nobody blames Selena because they all kind of get it. They all understand. And speaking of Clarice, she kind of gets her own little mini section of this chapter.
Yeah, she does. Clarice Dragonslayer. Feels like a name out of Game of Thrones or something.
Right?
I love it.
Yeah, yeah. It's its own moniker, for sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, she...
First of her name.
Aw. That's cute. I like it. No, Clarice kind of comes in, swoops in to hold Selena as she's dying. And once Selena has passed, is the first to say, you know, she's a hero. Nobody's going to say otherwise.
Yeah.
And, like, no one says otherwise. And Percy, even later in the chapter, corrects someone, you know, who says, like, but I also heard Selena. And
I think
it's
that,
like,
was one of the Stoll brothers, yeah.
And Percy says, she was a hero.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's it. And, yeah, but Clarice wants vengeance on Kronos for Selena, on Selena, you know, on Selena's behalf. And so she strings the dragon body up behind her chariot.
200 feet long.
I don't know how it's possible, but it's possible. Because then she just starts charging into battle and is wiping out monsters, and the Ares cabin is following her and just keeping things at bay, basically.
Yeah.
And she does some damage and then starts calling out Kronos. I can't envision it any different than Brad Pitt in Troy yelling, Hector! So, like, Clarice is literally just standing in front of a big army going, Kronos! In my head. I don't know any other way to envision it.
I think it's funny that she just kept doing laps around to, like, keep everybody back. And then, of course, the Blessing of Ares.
Yes!
Which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the first we've really heard of something like that. And she, like, glows red and she's as invincible as Percy is in that moment. And I think it's just because she is, like, she is the battle.
Yeah. Like, she's so entirely focused on vengeance and the battle and defeating her enemy that, yeah, the spirit of Ares just kind of flows through her, it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so that's scary. I did love that we got a little bit, like, to kind of wrap up the Clarice stuff. It was like Chris Rodriguez looks at Percy and is like, I'm going to keep an eye on her.
Yeah.
And see if I can get her sleep because she's going to need it. And that's when, like, Talia's like, well, the hunters will keep guard while she's hopefully sleeping as she's marching backward and forth in front of, you know, the Dracaene wall that is standing in front. I can just picture it. It's so visual and, yeah, it's funny. But, yeah. So, Chris Rodriguez is on Clarice duty. We'll let him handle that.
Mm-hmm.
Next, we get Annabeth and Percy kind of taking stock of what's happening. Like, they're kind of looking at the fact that they don't currently have a battle raging,
mm-hmm.
but they're also not really waiting on sunset either. It's kind of like a weird holding pattern as this goes on. And so they're taking stock of what they've got around them, their troops, whatever. And Percy kind of, somebody says something about reinforcements, and Percy goes, we might not be completely out of reinforcements. And he goes to Mrs. O'Leary and whispers something in her ear, and she shadow travels away.
Yeah.
I don't remember what this is. I'm assuming it has something to do with Nico.
Yeah, I assume that it's his undead army.
It's gotta be, right?
Because that's the only reinforcements they have left.
Like, either his undead army or Nico and Hades. Right, like, maybe yeah. he wants Nico to bring Hades. I do not specifically remember who he's summoning here.
Yeah.
But I'm assuming it has something to do with Nico and or Hades.
Yeah.
And or the dead.
It's Nico with either Hades or the undead army or both.
Right.
But it's gotta be Nico.
All of which would be very helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay. I was glad to know that it... I mean, that's the obvious pull with... It's Mrs. O'Leary. She's shadow traveling. She's a hellhound. It's right there in the name.
Yeah.
So it's kind of obvious, but it's also not obvious because I don't know specifically which part of that is what he was looking forward to. Anyway, we then see Percy, Annabeth, and Grover kind of together as Percy and Annabeth come upon Grover as he's helping Linnaeus basically pass this life.
Yeah. Can I tell you I teared up?
It was sad.
It was sad. I don't even like Linnaeus.
Nobody likes Linnaeus.
Yeah.
It was so sad.
And I think because it still meant something to Grover, you know? Like, the Seder Council, the Council of Cloven Elders, was not very nice to him.
No.
But they've been in charge of the Seders for so long. They held power and station within his community. And somebody's dying. Like, you can't not feel... Somebody that you knew for a long time is yeah. dying. You can't not feel something for that. And, yeah, it did. It made me a little sad. I also have to say, this is a little bit later, but I had two quotes for my favorite quotes, and I want to talk about this one now.
Okay.
Because it's just when they go up to Mount Olympus, and then he's, you know, they're, like, saying stuff, and Grover says, Linnaeus turned into a shrub, and he's carrying the little laurel, like,
sapling yeah.
with him. This is the first time that I distinctly pictured Aryan as Grover. Like, I could see him delivering that line, and it was so funny.
You know?
He's just proud of this little Linnaean shrub.
Like, is it sad that Linnaeus, in my head, is, like, planted in a boot? Like, Wally and the sapling?
Yeah, I feel like mine was, like, a little rickety or, like, a little fat around the middle or something. Yeah.
Right, like, I feel like he, like Grover grabbed somebody's shoe that was laying there that came off in battle and, like, grabbed the shoe and put the sapling in the shoe to carry it. Like, that's what my head goes to.
And he's just carrying it around in his arm.
Right, he's like, it's a shrub. I can see Aryan doing it. Yeah. It's gonna be fabulous. When we get there.
Yes.
But yeah, there was just something very poignant for me about Percy, Annabeth, and Grover having this very small moment, this very small break where they're riding the elevator up together. It's like, they started this, and they've never ridden this elevator together before. Yeah. Percy rode it by himself, but they've been here together before. Like, they've been in this moment, and so it just feels kind of a little bit full circle.
Yeah.
That at this moment, at this point in the battle where we're just about to get to the big stuff, they're together. They have a moment.
Yeah. It also feels like you can see how much they've grown in this moment. You can also see that, like, things are not perfect. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not super close in this moment because of everything that's been going on, because Grover has been separated from them for so long, off doing his own thing, and Annabeth and Percy have been sort of at odds over the whole Luke thing, and it's just like, things are a little tense in that elevator, but at the same time, they're still all on the same side.
Yeah.
They're still fighting for the same thing.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, we've spent so much time without Grover, and we were talking not too long ago about how Annabeth spends so much of the first half of this book, like, out of the picture because Percy yeah. is with Nico for so long. So it feels like it's been a million years since the three of them are together. So, like, it was a very well put together moment for us to kind of see them all in one place mm-hmm. again and to kind of finish up this whole chapter together. Like, they're not really, you know, linked up the whole time, but they're right. basically together for the yeah. rest of this chapter.
I also have to pause here for a second since we're talking about the elevator, because yeah. the Empire State Building elevator guard is nowhere to be seen.
Yes.
He ran away. His book is on his desk. He's gone. I don't think we've ever discussed this before, but do we think that the guard is mortal?
Well, here's my question. If he was mortal, wouldn't he be slumped over on the desk asleep?
Not if he could see through the mist like Rachel. Although Sally was asleep.
Yeah. Like, I think Rachel's a special case in this instance that if she had been in Manhattan, I don't know if she would have fallen asleep, but because she crossed through the border...
But the pilot fell asleep.
But she was awakened by the knowledge she had of what was going on. That was kind of my explanation for why she herself didn't fall asleep.
Well, I think because, you know, she's what Rachel. She is.
Yes.
I feel like that was, even though she's mortal, she is something more, which is why I thought she stayed awake.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe, like, what's literally going to be a thing...
Yeah.
...is more powerful than just seeing through the mist.
Than the curse, yeah.
So, like, that's why Sally fell asleep.
Right.
Is because Sally is not meant... doesn't have a destiny, isn't...
Yeah.
She is the mother of Percy. She is not destined to become right. something bigger.
And I think we read something a while ago that the older you get, the harder it is to see through the mist. It's easier when you're younger. Yes, that came from one of the short stories.
Yeah.
It's easier to see through the mist when you're younger. So maybe Rachel's just stronger in that sense than Sally is.
That could be too. Yeah.
So in that case, either the guard has a very strong sense, considering he's an adult, a strong sense of being able to see through the mist, or... My guess, and what I think would be really cool, is that he's actually, like, a minor deity in disguise. I would think that would be really interesting.
I think that would make sense, because the gods wouldn't want just a mortal person holding the key to Olympus on a regular basis.
Yeah.
Like, it would make sense to me if it was a minor deity, or, like, a nymph.
Yeah.
Or dryad or something like that. You know what I mean? Like somebody that has some sort of magic or power.
I mean, he could be a demigod too. Just
very possible.
An older one, which, you know.
Very possible.
Would be rare, but not impossible.
Especially if he spends any time in Olympus, like, it would be easier for him to stay alive.
Right.
Because on his off hours, he lives in Olympus as opposed to
right.
in the mortal realm. Like,
yeah.
That could explain how he's
the
older.
Gods could protect him because
they need
him
someone.
For the job. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely an interesting thing. But I did like that he just, like, left his book on the counter
yeah.
and dipped. Whatever, yeah. whoever it is, he just get out of it. I loved the scene with Percy and Annabeth and Grover taking a moment... Despite their focus on getting Olympus ready as they can, they took a moment to visit with the wounded and, like, encourage everyone. And, like, they don't necessarily have time for that, but they took a moment to walk through and to tell everyone, like, hey, you know, you're looking good. Like, you've got this. Like, just proves all three of them have been leaders from the beginning
mm-hmm.
in their own ways. And people thought Grover was nuts and... People think Annabeth's,
yeah.
you know, what they undervalue her, and Percy is Percy, but they really all have really great leadership qualities just in them, and it kind of popped out at this moment for
yeah.
me.
Yeah, yeah, and this is when Grover says, Linnaeus turned into a shrub.
Yeah. He's sharing his joy with
yeah.
yeah, with the injured and the infirm.
Oh, God, so funny.
Also worth noting, Will Solace and the Apollo cabin are the ones doing the healing.
Yes.
So he's up there... Safe and sound,
yep.
far away from battle at the moment.
Yes.
And I just liked knowing that.
When is Nico gonna see him?
Come on, Nico! While they were on the elevator, though, I was trying to figure out exactly where
yeah,
to put this.
It's a little...
And this whole chapter is a little hard to kind of nail down. But Annabeth confesses to Percy that Selena telling them about her role in this whole thing, being the spy and working with Luke... That is the thing that's convinced Annabeth that Luke is beyond saving. And rather than just, like, admitting that and saying, like, you know, I'm sorry that I was sticking by Luke all this time, like, I'm sorry I didn't see it your way or whatever, she goes, are you happy?
Yeah.
I mean, it fits Annabeth's character for me because she's not one to admit she's wrong very easily.
Yeah. And this has just been a point of contention for them
yeah.
for since basically like the fourth book too.
Yeah.
You
oh
know?
Yeah. 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 It doesn't feel out of character, but at the same time I'm like, it's okay to just admit that you've lost hope that Luke is still in there.
Yeah.
Like it's okay to admit that he might be beyond saving at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But for Annabeth, it feels like defeat. It feels like she's losing, you know, letting her friend down because she's not believing in Luke. Yeah. If, you know, it's hard. It's not easy. But I did like that Percy doesn't really, like, go after her either. Like, he doesn't, like, attack her. He's just kind of like, I'm not happy about any of this. Yeah. Like,
I think he recognizes that line in particular as a defense mechanism, too. Like, she's just in pain right now.
Yeah.
And he's not going to kick her while she's down.
Yeah. And he's maturing.
Yes.
So beautiful. Anyway. Okay, so that moment has passed. They're now back. They're in Olympus. They're entering the throne room. And they, upon opening the doors, see Hestia at the hearth. And she is a younger girl, which I assume has something to do with the god's power, like, draining, that she looks even younger.
Even younger than she did before?
I feel like that was kind of a thing that, that Percy was talking. Like, I don't know if it's, like, drastically younger, but it sounded like she was younger than the last time he saw her.
Okay.
I could be wrong. But, yeah, so we see Hestia, we see the Ophiuchorus, and then we see Rachel Elizabeth Dare, who Percy knew was at the Empire State Building, did not know she made it all the way to Olympus, and he asks her, like, what are you doing? She's holding Pandora's jar at the feet of Zeus's throne, and it, like, just feels so odd that she's there for me. Like, I was like, oh, yeah, what is Rachel doing there? Like, she just helped herself to Olympus, but she has a reason to be there.
Yeah.
So Percy kind of escorts her over to Hestia and makes introductions, and Hestia just greets her like she's been waiting for her for a decade.
And she has. I mean, she has. She knew that this was coming.
Yeah. And so they have this moment, and Rachel, I don't know if it dawns on her or if it's been kind of revealing itself slowly but surely, but she has a moment where she looks at Percy and is like, listen, I know we've kind of been, like, feeling some sort of pull toward each other, but I need you to know I don't have any pull toward you anymore. This was your world, your reality, the world of being, you know, a Greek demigod, all of that was, I was being drawn toward that for a reason, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And, like, I love Percy's reaction to it. I love the way he responds. Like, doesn't he say something like, so I'm just a distraction? Like, I was, you know, she describes it as him being a door for her, which I think is the best way to kind of picture it, is he was the entrance to this world, and that's why she was feeling so drawn to him, and now she doesn't feel that anymore. Like, it was not like, I want to be romantically interested in you. It was, I want to be around you and I don't know why.
Yeah.
And she just, you know, mistook it for a crush or for whatever we kind of interpreted it to be. But it was literally just her, everything inside of her trying to get her where she needed to be.
Mm-hmm. And I think on Percy's end, he's like, you know, I feel like I'm being dumped, but, like, we weren't even ever together. And I understand that sentiment. I don't remember this from
my read-throughs before.
But this moment really stands out to me because it's so interesting that, like, Percy was just a distraction for Rachel, that, like, she literally has to put her distractions aside to do what she needs to get done. That's what Hestia tells her.
Yeah.
And that they weren't meant to be. And I'm like, I mean, obviously I love Percy and Annabeth together. I'm always going to root for them. But I think that Rachel and Percy had some chemistry, and it's so interesting that it's like, well, there was it reminds me of Twilight with Jacob and Bella, and the only reason why Jacob was attracted to her was because he was meant to be with Renesmee, and I'm sorry to make that comparison, but it's the only thing I can think about.
I'm one who is less creeped out about the Renesmee of the whole thing. I know some people find that really creepy. Yeah. I understood what the whole pole thing was, and I think that is a really kind of an interesting way to compare the two. But you're right. Like, you think it might be one thing because, of course, that's what it is. That's the feeling. I'm having feelings. That's the only feeling. Yeah. And then once it dawns on you that there's another attachment there, there's some other reason, you completely lose that first thing. It's like, oh, that was never even okay. Like, I misinterpreted my own feelings. I misinterpreted those emotions and thought it was something else.
I'm not mad at the result of this, because the result is that Rachel is now not in the equation, and Percy can focus on Annabeth, and of course I'm happy about that, but I'm a little disappointed because it kind of feels like a letdown, like their relationship was fake almost, and like all that fighting between Percy and Annabeth was for nothing, and that Percy, I think, did have genuine feelings for Rachel in that, like, he was probably curious about, like, their connection, and now that just feels like, oh, never mind.
Yeah.
And then they just accept it and move on, and I'm like, I almost wish that this could have kind of played out the same way, but, like, that journey to get to that point happened differently.
No, I hear you. I kind of wish that maybe Percy wasn't confused about, like, did he have a crush on Rachel or whatever? I kind of wish maybe it had stayed platonic.
Yeah.
Like, that he had said, like, he's drawn to her, but, you know, because he has feelings for Annabeth, he likes Annabeth so much, like, it's not really that sort of a draw. It's, you know, but he just likes being around Rachel. Like, I would have really loved reading their relationship as strictly platonic, but that they just could not get enough of each other. Like, they couldn't spend enough time together when they had opportunities, and they really loved having time together. It doesn't necessarily have to be romance in order for that to be a strong tie.
Right.
So I kind of wish that maybe Rick had kept it platonic. So I see what you mean there, too. Yeah, it feels kind of cheap that once it dawns on her that this isn't what she thought it was, it's just like, okay, we're done here.
Yeah.
Because it's like
over.
Yeah. Because, like, Percy has feelings.
Yeah.
And he thought she had feelings. So, like, there was a lot going on for him. And now all of a sudden he's supposed to just be like, oh, you got it wrong. Oh, okay. Well.
Yeah.
All right. Have fun.
And I'll be very interested to see how we bridge the gap between this moment and him and Annabeth getting together in the end, because I think that's going to be really important to making me feel better about all of this.
Agreed, especially since Annabeth is still being kind of openly hostile toward Percy.
Yeah.
And, like, that whole thing
We don't have that many chapters left.
Well, and she doesn't respond at all to any of this with Rachel. Like, she has... Annabeth has no part of this conversation.
Yeah.
She's there, but she doesn't chime in at all. And I'd love to see...
I think she left at one point, and I know she came back, but I don't remember exactly when she came back, but she left them alone at one point because I remember being like, oh, she wasn't that hostile when she left. She was like, you guys got to figure this out. I'll be over
here. I think it's after Rachel says, like, you're a distraction. Or, so, like, Rachel says something that basically is like, hey, Percy, sorry. Because I think that's when Annabeth steps away. I could be wrong, but you're right. She does step away for a moment.
Yeah.
Because, like, I would have loved to have gotten her sort of perspective, or, like, maybe a bit of a respect shift between her and Rachel, because they sort of have, like, a mutual respect for each other a little bit, but they also have been very antagonistic toward each other. And with Rachel kind of saying, like, hey, by the way, I didn't realize it, but I have no interest in stepping on your toes here. Like, it should alleviate a lot of their issues.
Yeah.
And so I would have loved to have seen maybe a bit of that. Maybe it would have helped with the Percy of it all.
Yeah.
If we saw Rachel and Annabeth kind of patch things up too.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, we know eventually they do. We'll get there. That's a couple of chapters ahead. We should probably talk about Pandora's jar, because Rachel Elizabeth there is holding it. And when she greets Hestia, all that stuff, whatever. Percy has a moment. After the whole Rachel is breaking up with him, but they never were together thing. Percy just kind of it was so hard to summarize, because he's literally having this conversation. He's like, so we were never together, but now we're not together. Okay, whatever. And then he just kind of looks around and looks into the hearth and sees scenes of his mom and times around hearths in his life. So he's looking at scenes from camp and things like that where he's been around fire. And then he remembers something Prometheus said, and then he remembers Chris Rodriguez saying, "I told Clarice that there was no point in defending Camp Half-Blood if none of you were going to be alive to return."
Yeah.
And you see Percy seeing Nico talking to his dad and saying, like, if, you know, if Olympus is destroyed, your kingdom's going with it. Like, why are you staying down here? And for some reason, that is the thing that gives Percy all the direction, and he knows exactly what he needs to do now.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't tell us.
I mean, he tells us about Pandora's jar,
yes.
And, like, that part, I actually really loved this scene, because this is what the Sand Dollar should have been like.
Yeah.
Like, we see the logic in his thoughts. We can jump from one to the other and understand the conclusion that he comes to when he hands the jar to Hestia and gives it to her as an offering.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish that he had done that with the Sand Dollar, and I would have been fine with everything.
But any, like, explanation would have been better, yeah, than none.
But I actually really liked the scene, because for me, I could follow his logic, and, like, I know where he's coming from here.
I like it. I have issues. Not with the method of it, because I honestly like that he doesn't come straight out and say, like, here's what we're doing, here's what I have to do next. Because I kind of like that Percy knows what he has to do, and he's just kind of going to go and do it. He's not going to talk about
it. It also leaves some mystery for the readers.
Right, which, yeah, I like. I honestly like it. It's just kind of hard to nail down when you're trying to have, like, a conversation about it, because he never, there's not, like, a thing that happens where he's like, okay, now we're going to talk about this. But, no, I also really liked this moment. Just the idea of him kind of putting all these pieces together of all of these things that have been, you know, Hestia telling him, like, she had specific guidance for him earlier in the book, and it's kind of coming into play now. And yeah, so he gives Pandora's jar to Hestia as an offering and tells her to hold onto it and keep hope close to the hearth, because, like, that's where it will be safe, and he's not going to give up anymore. There's no chance he's not going to give up hope, because she's guarding it and keeping it safe. And I think that is, first of all, it's just a really beautiful sentiment. You may or may not hear the actual quote in a moment, because it's my favorite quote. But, like, it's such a beautiful, poignant little moment with the idea of hope and where hope festers, where hope, like, holds dearest, and where, yeah, it kind of stays hardest. Yeah. That brings us to him, like, running across the throne room. Like, he's like, hey, okay, thanks, Hestia. Rachel, don't do anything stupid. And then he runs across the throne room and asks for a boost.
Yeah.
And jumps into Poseidon's throne and almost gets blasted by his papa.
Yeah.
Honestly, this was it was genius on Percy's part, because realizing that in order to save Olympus, in order to save everyone, his father is going to make a massive sacrifice,
mm-hmm,
and that is his entire, basically, palace and kingdom under the water. He's still the god of the sea, but he's going to have to rebuild, because Cronos sent Oceanus to attack because he needed Poseidon to not be there.
Yeah.
He needed certain forces split up. It's why he's been doing things and attacking the way he has been. And it's genius. It's why he's got the demigods in New York City, and he's got all of the gods fighting Typhon as he marches across the United States. He's,
yeah,
got to separate these people from each other, otherwise they could defeat him. And Cronos knows it. So Percy realizes that Poseidon is the linchpin here. He needs to be in Olympus, he needs to join the gods to fight Typhon, and that will more than likely be the thing that, you know, turns the tide here. And Poseidon, I loved this whole moment between them. It's a very funny,
yeah,
it's the levity we kind of need at this,
right,
point in the chapter,
yeah,
after the death. and the seriousness and the life-changing relationship things going on. It was nice to get a moment between these two.
And Poseidon's reasonable.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed seeing that. I mean, he's a little upset at first and definitely angry at first, but then he trusts his son and he understands where he's coming from and believes him and then will do as he says. And I feel like not all the other gods would do that.
Yeah. I also enjoyed the check-in with Tyson.
Yeah.
Like, check-in to Tyson. Like, he's okay, right? And
Peanut Butter's a weird battle cry, but he's doing great.
But he's surprisingly doing, you know, he's kicking butt. So, I'm glad to hear that we know that Tyson is okay.
Yeah.
Because I do worry. But this chapter ends with Talia opening the throne room doors and saying, "You need to come. Kronos is leading his army and they're coming for us." Like, they're headed straight for the Empire State Building. So that's where we leave it.
Yeah.
A lot happened in that chamber. I know I say that every week.
Yeah.
But this time it was actually like kind of a lot.
There was a lot of really small moments that were actually really significant.
Like, supremely significant. Yeah. Yeah. Agreed, for sure. Okay, so we still need to do our favorite quotes and favorite moments, and I told you that you would hear mine in a moment because I kind of already talked about it, but mine is Percy's line to Hestia, and he says, "Hope survives best at the hearth. Guard it for me, and I won't be tempted to give up again." And it just...
I really got emotional during this part
because
he was just so smart and, like, it's just a really poignant moment and he did what needed to be done. Like, this was the thing that was going to decide what was going to happen, and Hestia is so proud of him in that moment and,
because he looks at Pandora's jar and says, like, I think he hears Prometheus and he, like, he's like, "I could give it up right now. I could just turn it over and nobody else is gonna die but bye-bye gods," you know? Mm-hmm. And he, instead of making that choice, he decides to hold on to hope, and that she's so proud. So proud. Hestia's proud too. What was your favorite quote?
Mine is Grover in the elevator when he looks at Percy and Annabeth and he's like, "Well, sure good to be together again. Arguing, almost dying, abject terror. Oh, look, it's our floor." Again, like, I just really see Aryan in this moment, and I'm so excited for it.
Filling the awkward tension.
Yeah.
I can see it, too. It's going to be brilliant. We just have to get season 5.
Yeah.
Balls in your court, Disney. As far as favorite moments go, mine was Percy's talk with Poseidon on the throne. Again, we needed a bit of that levity, and I love when Poseidon and Percy have a chance to kind of talk, and it's been a very long time since I feel like Percy, since he's last checked in with his dad.
Yeah.
And so it was really nice for him to say, like, "This is the thing. Like, why have I not thought of this before?" Like, I think Percy's kind of kicking himself for not thinking of talking to dad again before, but... it's a brilliant plan, and it's just a really nice little talk. What was yours?
Mine was Percy leaving Pandora's jar with Hestia. It's just an emotional moment. It has so much significance. It's so important, and I just loved it.
Good one. Good one. All right, so that wraps up chapter 17. Make sure to read chapter 18 for our next episode. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts as well. If you like revisiting your favorite canceled and cult classic shows, consider tuning in to Rewatchable for in-depth discussions about Firefly, Veronica Mars, Avatar The Last Airbender, Buffy, Angel, and many more. We also have Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with our favorite creators. Lastly, we also have Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which has discussed every episode of the show, contains exclusive interviews, and will be covering the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us your long-form thoughts to prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving us a review or a rating. 5-star reviews really help others to find us, and we love it. You can leave us questions or comments, ideas for content or episodes that you want to hear from us in any of these places. We love hearing from you guys. We do have one bit of feedback this week, and it was from our friend Daphne Olive, who had something to say about Frozen 2 and the documentary, getting this wrong. I'll let Karen take it from here.
Yeah, so Daphne held a poll asking people which one was their favorite Frozen movie, and I voted in it from the podcast, that Frozen 2 is my favorite. I knew that you wouldn't be too mad about that.
Nope.
And she basically said, my verdict is everyone needs to give Frozen 2 a rewatch. I know this has nothing to do with Percy Jackson. I mean, it kind of does, but... So then I said, Frozen is a great movie, but Frozen 2 has more mature themes that really resonated with me. I broke down sobbing when Anna sang the next right thing. I've never cried harder in a movie theater. It was intense, which is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. And then Daphne says, have you seen the behind-the-scenes documentary on Disney Plus? I didn't think those songs could make me feel more feelings than they did already. I was wrong. The documentary is amazing. And I was screaming because I was like, oh my gosh, Kristen and I talk about this constantly on the podcast. We're hoping for something as in-depth and lovingly curated for the Percy Jackson series. It was such an amazing behind-the-scenes look and really added to our love of the movie and its process. And, you know, Daphne is a writer on Percy Jackson and the Olympians, and she liked the tweet, and so maybe she will just, it'll be in her head, and then she will say it to the people who can make it, and then we will get our Percy Jackson making of documentary.
Because I just have to say, it would be even easier than the Frozen one, because as much as I love Frozen 2, and I love that documentary, I've watched it so many times, I can't even tell you. It would be easier because the Percy Jackson TV show has actors. Frozen 2 is an animated movie. They didn't have actors to talk to about the production. Like, they were talking to animators, mm-hmm. and you were seeing the process of making an animated movie, and it was really fascinating and really cool. But I feel like a documentary like that about behind the scenes to a show or a movie is going to be strengthened by the live action of it all and having these actors to talk to about bringing the characters to life. It, like, talking to the animators was really cool, but the animators are only one step in bringing that character to life. They also have voice actors and the, you know, all of the mechanics of making the actual animated people do the things. Like, you have to have the bones and the muscles underneath the actual animation of the character in order to make them do things. So, like, I feel like it would be so much easier to make one fantasy, is what I'm trying to say.
Let's do it.
A lot of words to say the one thing.
Yes.
But that's what I'm trying to say. And so, yes, thank you, Daphne. We hope that maybe we'll get to see one for Percy just like it, because it would be cool. Okay, so next week, we're thinking we're going to take our cue from the new year and do some New Year's resolutions, kind of look ahead at the 2023 calendar, and look, just take stock of what lies ahead and all the fun things that we have to look forward to. And I think that's a really, it's going to be a fun episode.
Yeah, I think so too. So if you guys have any Percy Jackson related resolutions, or if there's anything in particular you're looking forward to coming out and experiencing in 2023, preferably Percy Jackson related, let us know.
Or Rick related.
Yeah, or Rick related, or Rick Ryan Presents related. Let us know and we will shout you out on the podcast.
Sounds good. Until then, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.